Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Around the world, young people congregate on soccer pitches in Sao Paulo, baseball fields in the Dominican Republic, or basketball courts in the Bronx, mostly for the love of the game. But for many, in the back of their minds is that hope and prayer that sport will be that young person's ticket out of poverty. It's a long shot bet at best. In India, the sport is cricket. In fact, novelist Aravind Adiga says that this sport is one of the few unifying elements in this country of 1.3 billion people, with huge religious divides, language divides, and vast economic inequities. And just as some American parents will make any sacrifice to see their child become the next NFL, NBA, or Olympic star, in India, it's the selection day when young cricketers are chosen for the top professional teams and maybe even the India 11. Well, that's the backdrop for Booker Prize winner Aravind Adiga's latest novel, Selection Day, a coming-of-age story, but a larger look at India's own coming-of-age struggle as a rising 21st century nation. Chutney salesman Mohan Kumar has prayed to his God to bring cricket greatness to his sons, Radha and Manju. And with the zeal of divine affirmation, he molds them forcefully into just that. But Manju loves science and CSI, and while incredibly talented, is fairly ambivalent about the sport that's supposed to bring his family out of poverty. And he's also ambivalent about much more as the book progresses, and the book is a potent commentary on life in contemporary India. Adiga won the Booker Prize for his debut novel, The White Tiger. He's also the author of the story collection Between the Assassinations. His latest book is titled Selection Day. It's published by Scribner's. Aravind Adiga, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on, Rich.
In Selection Day, you're telling a coming-of-age story that could be set in a variety of places, say, the soccer fields of Sao Paulo, or an inner-city basketball court in New York City, or a baseball field in Latin America somewhere. But you're telling a story set in cricket in Mumbai, and a family and a father who is raising two boys to be great cricketers. What set you on this path for this novel?
Well, the situation in the novel where a man from the slums is obsessed with making his two sons the next great cricket players so he can lift his family out of poverty that way is a very archetypal story in India today. It's happening in a country of 1.3 billion that has just recently, say for about 15 years, become a capitalist economy, a very fast-growing, exuberant economy where people for the first time can dream of success, of becoming rich in their lifetimes. Cricket is a major spearhead, in a sense, of capitalism in India. If you come to this country, you'll see cricket is the dominant passion of India. It's something like baseball, basketball, football, and Christmas put together. It's that big. It's sort of hard to describe to an outsider. It's as if there were just one dominant sport in the United States, and even bigger than that could possibly be. And cricket is seen by many. It's played by everyone in India, from rich to poor, from every from Muslim to Hindu. It's one of the few things that sort of unifies this country that's so divided. It's often said that Indians have two real religions. One is cinema, or Bollywood, and the other is cricket. And for many, many poor people, cricket is seen as a way out of poverty because cricketers, if you get picked for the national team or even for Mumbai, you're going to make tremendous amounts of money. I mean, serious money in the sense, comparable to what a baseball player or a basketball player in America would make. And so people obsessively drive their sons. It's still very much a male sport in India. They drive their sons to succeed in cricket. And this is a game, this is a story. The novel Selection Day tells a story that is happening all over India right now. And not just in India, as you mentioned, presumably in other countries too. But it's happening in a really phenomenally large way in India right now.
I can only speak from experience from our own country, but just as a couple of generations ago, it was boxing, which was a very exploitive sport in which a young man's talents, there was a whole infrastructure to, one could say nurture, other could say exploit a person's talent. The same in basketball today with all sorts of youth teams and competitions that are, where kids are starting in their, about the time they hit puberty. And having scouts looking them, I assume it's the same in India today with cricket?
Yes, And it's interesting you mentioned boxing, Rich, because one of the inspirations for this, when I was trying to find a metaphor or a way to say it, was a film about boxing, which was made in Italy in the 1950s. The film is called Rocco and His Brothers. It's a classic of Italian neorealism of that era, made by a man named Luigi Visconti. And then the film, which I saw many years ago when I was a student in New York, the film tells the story of a group of Italian villagers in the years after the Second World War coming to Milan, which was a big city in Italy then, and trying to become rich, you know, looking for the dreams, and finding that the only way to actually make any money was in the sport of boxing. And boxing is, you know, in those days was a very vicious, brutal sport. And the brothers who come from the village to try and succeed in Milan discover they hate boxing because it's so brutal, but it's the only thing they can do. And eventually one of the brothers becomes a big boxing star in Italy, and everyone else back in the village thinks he's a great hero, but he hates what he's doing. I was very much struck by this contrast between the way people might see you as a sports star and what you might feel about actually being that star, because we tend to see sports stars in fairly simplistic terms, you know, as men who have achieved something, have become successful. I was intrigued by the possibility of creating a different kind of portrait of a successful cricketer, someone who seems to have succeeded but who actually hates what he's doing, who wishes he had a normal life, you know, who wishes he had succeeded in some other fashion. Because one of the things about cricket, as is true of so many sports, is that to succeed now in a country of 1.3 billion, a cricket team is 11 players. So you're trying to be effectively, you know, one of 11 in a country of 1.3 billion where everyone is trying to become a cricketer. The competition is so intense to succeed, you have to neglect your studies. It's very hard to be both a good student and a good cricketer. Pretty much what happens is your life from the time you're 5 years old until the time you're 16 is just cricket, playing it, you know, studying it, being obsessed with it. And it's impossible also to be a good student. And then your life just becomes one big gamble. At the age of 16 or 17, there'll be a time when you're selected for the team. You either make it or you fail. And if you fail, which is what, you know, happens to most people, it's a kind of story we don't hear about in, you know, the field of dreams sort of narrative. Most people trying to succeed in a professional sport will fail because the competition is so intense. Then, you know, you discover at the age of 16 or 17, you're a young man who might have dropped out of school, or even if you have got a school degree, you haven't really been studying. And your entire life has been this one thing, cricket, and now you're good for nothing. And then, you know, the real problems start, alcoholism, violence, drug abuse, and so forth. So I was very much struck by this contrast between the way we see sport, because we're exposed to, you know, ads on TV from Adidas, from Nike, which sports success stories are fed to us. This is true in India as well. And the reality, which is 99.9% of people trying to succeed in a sport will fail. I remember years ago in the United States when I was studying, I was an undergrad at Columbia, I saw an interview with Arthur Ashe, the tennis player, you know, who had been the first African-American to win at Wimbledon. And he said that he was very troubled by his own legacy because he knew that he was inspiring a lot of people to go into tennis and sport, but most people in sport fail at it. That is what you expect to fail. And the way to succeed is education. So I'm very troubled by the way we see sport. And, you know, this novel is a way to explore that.
You're absolutely right. For anyone to really, in any sport, it has to be a single-minded pursuit. And yet the odds are so stacked against success, from NFL football to basketball to soccer to cricket or any major sport in which you have lots of money to be made and adulation. It has to almost always be a single-minded vision at the expense of other parts of your life.
Yes, and the difference between America and India here is that in America, if you get a scholarship to a college, a football scholarship or something at that young age, at least technically you're still expected to study. There's, you know, because, you know, you're going to fail. You're probably not going to make it into a professional sport. And the system is trying to make sure that you have some backup. In India, we have nothing of that kind. We have no safeguards. And the novel selection day began about 6 years ago one evening in Mumbai when I sat down with an Indian businessman who told me that he was paying, you know, there's so much money in cricket, he wanted to get into it. And what he was doing was he was looking for talented young cricketers in the slums of Mumbai, because Mumbai has these enormous slums filled with people who want to get out of it. And he had come up with a very clever idea, which was to find young, talented cricketers and to pay their fathers a certain monthly stipend on the assumption that if the cricketers ever succeeded, the businessmen would then get, say, 50% of their marketing revenues. When, you know, Coca-Cola and Nike came to them, he would take half of these revenues. The first thing that came to my mind is something like this would be illegal in America, because I'd known that, you know, you have to be very careful when you give young people money to play football or basketball. And I know that there are quite a few cases where football coaches go to jail or at least are dismissed for offering money to young people to come to a college play, because this is a very risky proposition for a young man at that young age to give up everything, you know, to devote himself to a sport where he's, no matter how gifted he is, he's unlikely to make the cut. And in a country of 1.3 billion, when you have 11 players who are going to make it, the odds are just against you. What struck me was, in India, there's no, you know, there's no checks and balances, there's no security for the young boy. And these young boys in the slums, and this is happening across Mumbai and other Indian cities, are gambling everything upon, you know, one throw of the dice, making it as cricketers. And I began to think, what if there was a young boy from the slums, because many of them are very gifted in academics, who just wanted to be an engineer or a doctor, who wanted to study and keep studying.
Who wants to, he loves CSI.
Yeah, which is, you know, you actually meet these young boys who are very precocious, very gifted intellectually, and, you know, could easily make it in life in some other field. The problem is, though, is if your father has decided, and Indian families are still very patriarchal, much more hierarchical than American families would be, if your dad has decided that you're going to be a cricketer, you know, you pretty much have to do what your father says. And the idea that someone, you know, who appears to be a sporting success might actually hate what he's doing was, you know, an idea that obsessed me, because I remember reading Andre Agassi's autobiography and discovering that he absolutely hated being forced to play tennis. And the more he hated it, the better he became. So there are lots of ironies in this idea of a sports star who hates what he's doing. And the more he hates it, somehow, you know, self-hatred can help you in some fields, the better he becomes as a cricketer. But he really just wants to get out and have a normal life.
Well, in the case of your protagonist, Manju, the son of Mohan Kumar, two brothers, Radha and Manju. Manju is set up to be the second best batsman because his older brother, Radha, is supposed to be the best batsman. But Manju is...
cricketing talent, and this may be true of baseball, I'm not sure, cricketing talent often runs in families. You tend to meet lots of brothers who are gifted. I'm assuming, you know, that athletic talent is inherited to some extent. So I did meet a lot. I did a lot of research for this book. I you know, spoke to a lot of brothers, a lot of young, promising cricketers from the slums and from poorer backgrounds in Mumbai. And I was struck by how many brothers there were, you know, prospective brothers. And the father typically, in very patriarchal fashion, decides the elder one is going to be the one to succeed. But life isn't that way. You know, the younger one, who's often very brutally called the backup to his face, the backup sometimes ends up being better than the one who's supposed to succeed in the father's plan. Yeah, I wanted to explore that as well.
Well, I was struck by, as you were talking about, you know, basically Manju is a person who's at best ambivalent about the sport. But given the way cricket is played, and there's this great sequence in the novel where Manju is a batsman in a big match, and he is just going crazy. And, of course, it's not an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours like a tennis match. It's days.
Yeah. Well, cricket is a game of great endurance, especially in the Indian heat. I mean, you know, it's just grueling. It is a fairly brutal sport in many ways. And cricket is meant to be that. It's meant to be a test of pain, of endurance. You know, it is a great sport of the British Empire. And what the British of the 19th century prided themselves on was the stiff upper lip, the capacity to endure pain. And this is, again, something that may set cricket apart from most American sports, because they tend to be about, you know, speed or strength. Cricket is ultimately about coping with pain. In that sense, that's another theme of this novel, coping with pain. And cricket seemed a uniquely suited vehicle for that theme.
My guest today is Aravind Adiga, Indian novelist. He won the Booker Prize for his debut novel in 2008, The White Tiger. His latest novel is already getting wonderful reviews, Selection Day. It's published by Scribner. It's now out in the United States. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. You've created some amazing characters in this book. You mentioned the father who's set up this incredible regime with, well, certainly by American standards, bizarre rules in how he runs his house and tries to produce these cricketers. Mohan Kumar, tell us a little about this character.
Well, if you ever come to a cricket match in Mumbai, a school cricket match, that is, you'll see, you know, these kids in all white uniforms running about a cricket oval, a green oval. And then you'll notice at the sidelines, just outside the ground, that there'll be a man with a bicycle yelling at the top of his voice, just threatening to kill someone. And you'll discover he's yelling at his two sons, his one or more sons who are playing in the game, telling them exactly what he's going to do to the boy if the boy doesn't perform better. This obsessive father is such a ubiquitous feature of cricketing matches in Mumbai at the school level. I've met so many of them, and they have very predictable stories. They're men who have somehow failed in life to do what they wanted. They've come from a village to Mumbai to succeed. They've failed, and they've transferred their hopes onto their son or sons. And these men, you know, are both inspiring and disturbing. What I would admire is India is a difficult place to succeed in. You know, it's a country of 1.3 billion, which is growing fast now, but it's still a tough country to make it, to become, you know, rich in. And these men have refused to sort of give up, and they've transferred their hopes onto their sons. Now, that's inspiring. What is more disturbing is this obsessive quality of, you know, controlling every aspect of their sons' lives, from the way the sons, you know, eat, from the way the sons dress, the way they comb their hair. And what I was trying to do in Mohan Kumar was to give a composite portrait of many, many men I've met in Mumbai whose only aim in life now is to make sure their sons succeed. The extremely driven father. And in more cases than one, it is just a father, because I'd noticed that in a couple of cases, these men tend to be so difficult to live with that their wives just leave them. I was very struck by two fathers who were doing this alone,
right,
with no wife around. And you know, obviously, there are also Mohan Kumar. His character shades into questions of abuse, of you know, excessive control. That might seem disturbing to American readers, but in India, it's still, you know, these things happen, and the law is different here. So,
he struck me as a combination of the most radical sports parents. You know, somebody who's guiding their child to athletic success, and a stage mother.
Well, he's both father and mother in that he's completely, you know, in charge of his sons. But I didn't want him to be a caricature, and you know, I wanted him to be someone who's conscious, a poor man who's conscious of the odds he's against. Many of these cricketing fathers are very intelligent men who studied about nutrition, about science, about sport, about how to make, you know, cricketing champions. And there's a common sense of frustration. You know, so one of Mohan Kumar's sayings is, the big thief walks free, small thief gets caught. Because this is a common sense of resentment among many of these very intelligent lower class men who have failed in life and have just sort of transferred their hopes onto their sons. I want, you know, him to be a living portrait to many of my more affluent readers in India of the kind of resentment and anger and crackling anger that exists just below the surface in India, to which many of my readers might just not be aware of, because people like Mohan Kumar typically are your servants, your domestic staff in India. They're the men who drive your cars, who clean your homes. They are men whom you're trained from the time you're a child, if you are well off, not to hear. And these men deserve to be heard, and there's a lot of intelligence and a lot of anger down there that has always obsessed me from the time of my first book, The White Tiger. And so while Mohan Kumar is a disturbing and unpleasant figure, he's also someone whose intelligence and whose voice deserves to be heard, I think, in books.
And I think perhaps the better way of describing that is being invisible, you know,
yeah,
helpful but
yeah,
invisible.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's a huge problem in India, because so many people are still poor, and the middle class in India just does not hear about poor people, except occasionally at elections when all the wrong candidates tend to win elections in India, because it's the one time when, you know, your driver and your maid get to speak up, is when they turn up in the elections and they vote. The problem of invisibility, and people can be invisible on so many levels. In the United States, I haven't lived in America now for a decade. My general sense is the focus in literature, quite correctly, has been on shining a spotlight on voices that have been invisible because of, say, gender or sexual identity, like, you know, bringing mm-hmm. more women or you know, gay Americans into the literary and the cinematic spotlight. In India, invisibility is still a function of economics. It's just, you know, people who are not well off are just invisible still. And that has been my primary interest from the time I've come back to India, which was years ago. It's just bringing people who are missing from literature and the national debate here into the spotlight.
And you contrast this in Selection Day by the two boys are great cricketers in Mumbai and of their age. And you have another boy, a Muslim, Javed Ansari, who is middle class and far more ambivalent about his cricketing future than even Manju.
Right. Because cricket, you know, historically in India was played by the middle class, by more affluent people. And increasingly now, because as a 16-year-old middle-class boy, your father or mother will give you the right advice, which is not to spend all your time playing, but to study and to go to university. The middle class tend increasingly, you know, they can't make the cut into the national team. So it's more the absolutely obsessively driven slum boy who is now making it into the national team in India. But I was the people you see in Selection Day, the characters you see in it, are all figures that I've actually met as I was doing research for this novel. And originally, the book was just supposed to be a story about two young boys, just the two brothers and their father. What happened was, as tends to happen when you're researching a novel, is a new character drops in and just asks to be part of the story. And in the course of my, you know, the 5 years I spent researching this in Mumbai, I did meet a very striking young cricketer, 16 or 17 years old, a Muslim boy from Mumbai who was very clearly gay and a cricketer. Mm. And this sort of struck me as both very obvious and very unusual, because sexuality in India certainly is still not something that's discussed very openly. And the fact that here was a boy who was aware of his sexuality, who was playing cricket, suddenly took this book in a completely new direction. And you know, I was curious to know, in so many ways, the real person on whom the figure of Javed Ansari is modeled was a revelation to me, because he was well off, he was very intelligent, he was Muslim, and he was also very aware of his own sexual orientation, and he was playing cricket, you know. And I thought this turned what was meant to be a cricket novel into something completely different.
Yes.
And my publisher certainly was appalled by the idea of a gay cricket novel, you know, which as a cricket novel is hard enough to sell, and a gay cricket novel was too much for some of the people who with whom I was working. So the figure of Javed just forced himself into this book, and I couldn't not write about him once I discovered this person. But yeah, it made the writing of the book very complicated, and it made it a very different book from the one I'd imagined at the start.
And it's a much better book too, and because of this character. And I have to tell you, you're taking on so many institutions in India, certainly within sport. Sexual orientation is probably, you know, this is one of the last areas where this is still really controversial, at least in the West. It's far more controversial in India, and I would think sport
Yes.
is probably the most conservative area there within that conservative overall society.
Yeah, well, not just in India. Cricket, you know, it's interesting. Cricket is played, it's a big sport in Australia and England. And a friend of mine in Australia was telling me that even in Australia, which is very liberal on sexual orientation, even there, almost no sportsman, no cricketer, professional cricketer has ever come out and admitted to being gay. Even in a country that liberal as Australia or England, it still is taboo for sportsman in an all-male game like cricket to say that he's openly gay. So yeah, I was obviously a cricket and male sexuality, and the fact that so many cricketers clearly are gay in India but can't come out and admit this was something that intrigued me. But the taboo is not just in India. It, obviously here in a country, in India, homosexuality technically is still illegal. There's been a law from the 19th century. It's no longer enforced, and society is opening up. But still, it's still a subject you cannot talk about freely in many parts of India, especially obviously in the Muslim community where it's particularly a taboo. So the idea of you know, upsetting a large number of people by bringing in this angle of sexual orientation into a cricket novel certainly came up. You know, it certainly was one of the things I was trying to do to make this book as close to unpublishable as possible.
And yet,
which is a real slog to get it published in the end. I wasn't consciously trying to violate taboos. These things are happening. You know, there are gay cricketers. There are many gay Muslims in India, and the idea of a gay Muslim is also someone who's not adequately represented in our literature in India. Muslims make up about 14% of India, or 15%. They're a minority here, and in many ways, they tend to be represented in cliches in literature. The idea of a well-educated, prosperous young Muslim man who's aware of and confident in his own sexuality, which is the reality on the ground. You meet people like this. Mm-hmm. The idea of bringing him into my book was something that was important to me.
Yeah. The name of the book is Selection Day. My guest is Aravind Adiga, Indian novelist. He won the Booker Prize for his debut novel, The White Tiger. Now, you've lived in the UK. You've lived in the United States. I think you might have actually lived in Australia at times, in addition to India. And yet, you're back in India, and you're writing books about India. And you've sort of alluded to some of the reasons. There's this massive change in India. And you're looking at these institutions like family that are certainly undergoing great stress. This seems like this is the place to be for you as a writer.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the India was a closed-off socialist economy. So I lived in India until I was 16 when my mother died. I'd never gone abroad. And that India was a socialist economy of a very slow-growing, stagnant place, and of quite a traditional hierarchical society. And that society has long vanished as India has become a capitalist country. And then the rate of transformation is so extraordinary. When I was a student at university in America and later at Oxford in England, I read a lot of the 19th century novelists, you know, like Dickens, like Flaubert, like Zola. And when I came back to India, it occurred to me that the India I'm living in now is something like Europe of the 19th century, something going through such extraordinary changes. And many traditional institutions have been, you know, weakened and have been assaulted by the changes, but there's also a tremendous upswell of self-confidence. You know, it is extraordinary to see India, which is a very hierarchical society with a rigid caste system that has lasted for several thousand years, to see that hierarchy break down, which releasing a tremendous amount of entrepreneurial energy, you know, a real buccaneering, do-it-yourself, break-the-rules sort of spirit here. It's quite exciting as well to be recording and writing about a country going through such change in such a tremendously short period of time.
Aravind Adiga, thank you so much for your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
Booker Prize winner Aravind Adiga's latest novel is titled Selection Day. It's published by Scribner. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.